Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, now in depth on what single-payer health care really is. For many Democrats, it's the health care fix that got away. Indeed, every time we talk about health insurance and Obamacare, we get calls from you suggesting that we wouldn't be in this mess if we only had single-payer. A Pew Research Center poll found in 2016 that 39% of Americans said they'd support single-payer, a Medicare-like plan. But when they were asked if they'd give up their own employer-sponsored plan for a government-run plan or pay higher taxes for single-payer, well, that's where the support dropped off. And yet politicians are talking again about single-payer, including all of the Democratic candidates who are running in House Speaker Paul Ryan's district in Wisconsin. That's for 2018. Today, a discussion about what single payer really is and why support for it seems to be growing. So I want to know what you think about this. Would you give up your employer-sponsored health insurance for a single payer insurer, the government, to take over? What do you think would be better about single payer? What if it cost more? Is it worth it? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Dr. Arkell Giorgio is a physician and president of Giorgio Consulting. She is also executive in residence at the Carlson School of Management, and she's the author of Healthcare Choices. Welcome back. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Gerald Kaminsky is with us. He's the director of the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research. And he joins us this morning from L.A. Jerry, welcome back. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you.
I want to be clear about kind of where we are in the healthcare landscape. And Arkell, I'll bring this to you first. We have a mix of employer-sponsored health insurance. We have some single-payer-like programs through the VA and Medicare. And then there's the healthcare exchanges. Would a full single-payer law mean that we would all be under one government insurer?
Well, Carrie, single payer doesn't have one definition. And that's what we all need to understand is certainly one model is that the government is the insurer, is the payer for all. But there are other models that are considered single payer, but it is administered in a different way with private health insurance, where there's simply a mandate where everyone must have insurance. So when we talk about will it work, the question is, what model are we talking about?
Okay, so Jerry, should we look to Canada for one model? And then where else can we look for some of these other models that Arkell's mentioning?
Yeah, Canada is certainly the closest model, but it's only one version. And Europe, Israel, Australia, New Zealand, we've got lots of different ways that governments provide universal access to health care for their citizens and residents that are single-payer or single-payer-like. There are lots of different models out there.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
And when we talk about the ability for some people in one kind of single-payer system, would you potentially have your employer-sponsored health care, or would you buy policies on top of it? How would the private insurance market play out in this?
So, again, that can vary. I mean, the United States, we can do whatever we want to do here, but what most countries do is guarantee an essential benefit package that is covered with public funds and then allow, to perhaps a limited extent, private insurance in addition to cover things that are not part of the essential benefit package. And you could easily imagine something like that in the United States. Let's say, for example, we guarantee that everybody has coverage for hospital care in the United States, mm-hmm. but you buy private insurance for outpatient care, your doctor's visits, your prescription drugs, for example. We can structure this however we want. There's not one just one way to do it.
Arkell, is there any guarantee that premiums would be lower if we were in some kind of full single payer, some kind of mixed single payer plan, as you guys are describing? And here's why I ask. I remember that during President Obama's reelection campaign in 2012, the CBO actually came out with a score and projected premiums for single payer would be higher than what Americans were paying then for their health care premiums. So in these models of single payer, is it a guarantee that health care will cost less?
It's not necessarily a guarantee. And here's why, Carrie. In the single model or single model like single payer like models across the country, mm-hmm. there are common components. And one is everybody gets covered, even those with pre-existing conditions. Everyone must have insurance. But they also include a component of the provider system, the doctors, the hospitals, the drug companies, all having their costs regulated. And that is what brings the cost of care down. So if, in fact, we would have a single payer model system and took the step to do that too, controlling costs, then we could potentially see premiums coming down. The other component that's present in Europe, in Canada, in the UK, et cetera, is that benefits are limited as well. So I think the theme that we need to understand when we talk about single payer is that we need to absolutely bring the cost of care down in ways that the Affordable Care Act has not addressed.
I want to make sure everybody heard what you just said, though. Yes, costs might come down. Benefits, what you get for your health care, for your covered health care, might diminish too under this.
That's absolutely right. Let me give you a single example. There are many. I was just on the National Health Service website this morning, and just as a single example, chiropractic care, for example, is not covered. I can give you dozens and dozens of examples of care that we as Americans would expect to receive in our benefit plan package, and it might not be available because it's not affordable in a future system of care.
Let me grab a call. I think Carol wants to talk about healthcare costs. Hey, Carol, hi. Thanks for waiting. Hey, Carol, are you there? Ah, we might try to get her back there. To Steve in Grand Marais. Hi, Steve. What are you thinking about?
Yeah, you know, if you want to make it fair, people that get employer-paid health insurance get it tax-free, whereas other people have to pay taxes on that money before they could even buy the policy.
Uh-huh.
Let's make it fair.
Is that more fair, Arkell?
That's a very good point. And those provisions are being addressed in even current laws that are being discussed in Washington.
To the phones, to Roger in Minneapolis. Hi, Roger.
Hi, thanks a lot. Take a look at Taiwan. They followed the Medicare plan that we had here, that we have here in the United States 20 years ago. They got the lowest health care costs in the world. They got the best health care coverage in the world. Everybody is in. Everybody's covered. There's no more health insurance company running the show. There's no more malpractice insurance. So the lawyers are out. The insurance companies are out. They're all for profit. Everyone must go to their yearly checkup, which will reduce costs by discovering health care problems and fixing them in advance.
So, Roger, we have a lot of people that want to speak here. So you're saying let's look to Taiwan. Jerry, the pros and cons of a Taiwan-like model.
Well, Taiwan is a good example. They did this successfully, and overall the system is working fairly well. The biggest disadvantage is the political barrier to setting rates. Can we set a single rate for doctors and hospitals in this country under a national health insurance program?
Why is that such a barrier? And I know we're going to spend a little bit of time on this.
Yeah, it's been a barrier because it levels the playing field, that's for sure. And I think the biggest advantage is that when you walk into a doctor's office or when you're hospitalized, the care that you receive or the priority that you receive, I should say, is no longer based on the insurance card that's in your wallet. And I think that leveling the playing field that way is what we need to do as a country. The problem is that means that we reshuffle the deck, and patients that previously were quite profitable are now not as profitable.
Wait a minute, you said patients. Do you mean providers?
No, I mean patients now. So what it means, and this is the barrier for doctors and hospitals. It means that now you can sort of target your patient population in a way that maximizes your income.
I see.
Privately insured patients are much more profitable than Medicare, and Medicare is more profitable than Medicaid generally. And so the current incentives in our system, which I think are perverse, is that doctors and hospitals have an incentive to target their patient or their patient mix. And that's one of the things that a single-payer system would eliminate.
Arkell, would we also eliminate an example like this from the International Federation of Health Plans? Average cost of an MRI in the U.S., around $1,100. In France, $363. If you take a statin and you're not on Medicare, you're paying about 400% higher for that prescription here than you are in the U.K. Would single-payer resolve that?
It could if that provision was put into the law.
The regulation, again, of cost.
Absolutely. Okay. And my question would be is, you know, when I look at the Medicare for All bill that's been proposed in Congress.
Bernie Sanders is.
That's right.
And
supported by 111 other Democrats. So it's not just Bernie Sanders. Do we need to completely overhaul our system to get to setting prices, negotiating, particularly drug prices? Do we need to change everything to get to this issue of the core aspect of the problem, which is these extraordinary prices on MRIs, on drugs, on hospital stays? Can we address that?
Do I hear you saying kind of no, we don't have to upset, tear apart everything. We could do some strategic regulation.
Absolutely. And when I looked at this bill that's been proposed, the transition would take 15 to 20 years. It would take an entire generation. So everybody calling in is not going to benefit from that type of bill. It would take too long. But there are things we could put in place sooner rather than later that would address premiums and expand access.
Like
what we just talked about, controlling costs, regulating providers and drug companies more than we do today.
So, Jerry, the government would come in and say to MRI providers, this is what you may charge anywhere, below this, but this is the ceiling on what you may charge for an MRI. Well, why can't we do that? Why isn't that done now?
Again, it gets back to sort of the politics under the current system, Medicare does that, and Medicaid programs do it. They don't negotiate with doctors and hospitals. What they do is they say, here's the formula. When a patient, you know, receives this service, an MRI, or when a patient's hospitalized for, let's say, an appendectomy, this is what you will be paid. And there's no negotiation. So hospitals and doctors say, okay, fine, we know that from government payers, which might account for 50 or 60% of our total patient load, we have no power to change what we're being paid. For the remaining part of the market, we do, and that's where we make most of our profit. So if you're going to get doctors and hospitals on board with regulation, you're taking away something from them that they right now find the system is working for them in terms of privately insured patients, where they're able to make a lot more money.
Got it. Arkell, you wanted to add?
Sure. Well, certainly, just as Jerry said, the government does do that for Medicare, for doctors and hospitals. But by law, not allowed to do that with drug companies. And so we see drug costs soaring. So let me transition to an example, again, from the UK. There's a drug called Repatha. It is an injectable drug that's used when you have high cholesterol and you can't get it down with normal statins. In the United States, that costs $14,000 a year. In the UK, they'll cover it, but only if the drug company will deliver it at $8,000 a year.
Wow.
So why can't we do that here?
Right. Arkell Georgiou with us from the Carlson School of Management and the author of Healthcare Choices. Jerry Kaminsky with us, director of the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research. And to the phones here, by the way, if you've just gotten in on the conversation, you asked for a show on single payer. Here it is. I think it's a little more complicated than a lot of people think, but we're talking about the ups, the pros, and the cons of single payer. The legislation that's before Congress right now, introduced by Bernie Sanders and supported by a lot of Democrats, what should we really understand about what single payer means? And can we do some of this without moving to full single payer? 651-227-6000 for your questions and your thoughts. 800-242-2828 on Twitter, where Michael says single payer must include much lower drug costs, allow us to buy drugs from any country, and much shorter drug patent periods. To the phones to Carol. Carol, you're back with us. Hi. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Yes. I'm a recently retired RN, and my husband is a retired physician. He was co-chief of primary care at the VA in Minneapolis.
Right.
What we want to say is we are really advocating for Medicare for all through Physicians for a National Health Program Minnesota and Healthcare for All Minnesota. And I agree with what the previous discussion was. It is about the cost that we are not negotiating for. We are 2.5 times the cost of any other developed nation because we don't do this. So it is one way we could do it, but then it leaves out all the people that are paying high premiums, high deductibles, the things that didn't work with Obamacare. And really, it is cheaper. It's been proven to be cheaper to have a publicly funded, privately delivered system like Canada. The VA is like UK. It's socialized medicine where the government owns the hospitals. We have tons of hospitals and clinics that would stay in business. So we wouldn't have backups like Canada that people are comparing it to because we have our clinics and hospitals ready to go.
Okay.
And as far as the tax, it would be the premiums. You wouldn't have premiums. You would just pay a tax like you do for Medicare.
So, Jerry, what do you make of Carol's argument here?
Well, I think there are a lot of strengths to the argument. And her final point, I think, is one worth emphasizing again, which is that one of the objections that people have to the idea, the concept of single payer, is that, well, now we're going to have to pay taxes. We have health insurance benefits. The majority of Americans get health insurance benefits through their place of employment. That, although the premiums are shared between employer and employee, that is effectively a tax. It is, we are paying a tax for health care. Our employers are contributing to it. And converting that into a tax that's paid to a government agency is really just, almost a sleight of hand. It's not raising new taxes per se. It's converting what is already a tax on our payroll into a tax that goes into supporting health care.
A good question here from Terry on Twitter, Arkell. She says, couldn't this be more manageable if it was done using a state-by-state system, or does that just make it more complicated? Senator John Marty, a state senator from Minnesota, of course, Governor Dayton, they want some the ability to pass some kind of single-payer option, a public option in the state of Minnesota. Does it make it more complex if each state tries to pass their own idea of this? Does it really need to be federal to work?
Well, my question is, do we really want to figure this out 50 times?
Mm-hmm.
And do we want the people in Texas to have a different set of standards and healthcare access than the people in Vermont? Personally, having come out of the business world as a physician, I think that that would be highly inefficient. And we have one nation that should have equal access to care. So why are we figuring it out 50 times? Having said that, many of the models of a single payer system, while it may be funded federally, it's still administered relatively locally. And so we need to remember that. I don't think that a single payer in Washington, D.C. or the capital of any country could really efficiently distribute care. So it is, even if it's federally driven, it's usually regionally managed.
And is that because the federal government provides money and then states, in essence, use that money as needed for their populations? Or why do you say that it's usually run, managed locally when it comes out of the federal government, even now?
Well, and I'm referring to other countries as well that have other districts.
Got
so
it.
They may take in the money at their national government level, but then they send it out into their regional systems, like in Canada. It's done that way. But here's the disadvantage that we need to just remember of what we'd be dealing with. So those regional areas, whether they're states or larger regions, get a budget. And they have an amount of money to work with. And when that money runs out in October of a given year, then they start cutting back on who gets what care. And we need to remember that that could be a potential disadvantage of a system like this.
So, Jerry, state by state, more complex, and as Arkell suggests, figuring this out 50 times. What do you think?
Yeah, I tend to agree with her. I think that state variation, it's nice to have the, in theory, the ability of states to tailor programs to meet local and regional needs. The potential problem is that you get 50 programs that may vary in terms of quality and generosity. And I think if we're going to have a federally funded or nationally funded healthcare system in the United States, we need to maintain some uniform standards so that we don't see dramatic differences between Texas and California.
I was just going to say, don't we have those dramatic differences now in precisely the states you just mentioned?
Yeah, well, and that's fine as long as the states are funding those differences. But if the federal government's going to be responsible, I think that we need to maintain some national standards.
A call here from Noel in White Bear Lake. Hi, Noel.
Hello.
Hi. What are you thinking about?
Well, I just had a comment. Well, actually, I'm just repeating an idea from a Canadian friend of mine.
Okay.
She said, with all the brilliant young talent we have at the universities, with our young people, with technology, why doesn't somebody, some politician, it could be Trump, it could be the Republicans, it could be anybody, have a contest and come up with a new model? Because all the models that we're talking about, they don't seem to completely address the increased cost that we're going to suffer as a result of the aging population. And I think we need some sort of system or model that figures out a way to incentivize people to not just use healthcare unlimitedly. And I think right now it's kind of set up that way.
Now Noel, now you've gotten to something that we're going to talk about next Monday that I could spend hours on. I think this is super interesting. Jerry, next Monday, we're going to talk about how much is too much when it comes to sharing the cost of your health care. She's bringing up something really important here about how individuals have to think about the way they're going to use health insurance and health care. Does Obamacare address that in any way?
It does in some ways, but Obamacare was not primarily intended to fundamentally change our healthcare system. You have to remember that this law, the Affordable Care Act, was in a sense an attempt to fix one of the remaining gaps in U.S. health insurance coverage, which is the individual market and the fact that Medicaid eligibility was restricted to categories of poor people, not all poor people.
Mm-hmm.
So the Affordable Care Act attempted to close two major gaps in our existing quilt of different ways of funding health insurance in the United States. The issue of cost growth in the future has got to be addressed at some point. It's very clear that the Affordable Care Act primarily kicked that can down the road. It was not an attempt to try and rein in overall health care spending in the United States. And I think future health care reform has got to tackle this issue head on. We can't afford to continue to assume that we'll fix it in the future.
And Arkell, what is the role of the patient/individual American in that discussion that Jerry says we have to have?
Well, I think that individuals need to take more personal responsibility in their care. That's what my book is all about.
Right.
And making health care choices that are the care you need and the care that you want. And we know that no consumer-driven decision is going to be the right decision for you unless you weigh into it. There is nothing in the Affordable Care Act that supports that, that drives that, or that promotes it. And so I think that we need to remember to include consumers, patients, into this whole equation.
When we did the healthcare forum upstairs, you were a part of that. We spent a fair amount of time talking about what we really mean when we say you've got to bring individual Americans and patients into this. And what some people go to immediately is, I see. You want to ration my health care. You want to give me this, but you don't want to give me that. Where does the individual come into that conversation in a practical way? You know what I'm asking? If you're ill, you want the best care you can get, and you want it now. How do we think about this in a more long-term and practical way?
We've tried to think about it by giving patients skin in the game, by creating high deductible health plans, and by saying that if people have choice and they have skin in the game and they have some level of control, then they will make the right decisions. That is a step in the right direction. But what we've seen is that that's simply not enough, because the system is not designed culturally or economically to help people weigh into their own healthcare choices.
Do you remember we spent a long time talking about diabetes in the context of this conversation? And that's an interesting chronic disease in light of what we're talking about right now.
Absolutely.
Jerry, what would you say to that?
Well, you know, I'm a public health professional, and I believe that we certainly can do a better job of including people in their own health promotion and preventing disease. It's an important component. But I'm also, you know, I'm concerned that your listeners don't get the wrong idea that somehow we are primarily in control of our health. Our health is determined by a lot of different factors, many of which are not within our control, including our underlying genetics, environmental exposures, et cetera, et cetera. So this idea that, you know, I'm primarily the person in control, mm-hmm. and that I can, for example, by living a healthy lifestyle, never get cancer or heart disease, is just, you know, contrary to the evidence. The fact is that we get sick, we're human beings, we have exposures that we're not aware of. You know, breast cancer is a good example. Most breast cancer patients have no family history or no risk factors, and yet they get breast cancer. So I just don't want us to think that we're going to be able to, by being more informed consumers and more engaged in promoting our health, be able to live a disease-free life.
Jerry Arkell has to come back on this.
I've just been waiting. Jerry, I respect you greatly, but that is a politically correct answer. I fundamentally disagree that people's health is not in their control. Certainly, there are bad things that happen. We get cancer. We get into a car accident. Other things happen. We just may genetically have, be destined to have heart disease. But studies do show that 80% of health issues are driven by behaviors. And let's start with obesity, but not stop there, and talk about smoking, alcohol, driving a motorcycle without a helmet. Let's go on and on and on, sexually transmitted diseases. So much of our healthcare is completely driven by the choices we make and the lifestyles and the behaviors that we have. And shouldn't we be responsible for that instead of just putting our hands up? And I have to tell you, I've done a lot of media, and it always seems like it's a no-go zone to talk about how people need to be responsible for their care. And it may be politically correct, but we're not going to have true health reform unless we start talking about it.
Jerry?
I think what we disagree on is not on the underlying premise, it's the proportion. I don't think that 80% of our health is determined purely by our own behavior. And I don't think that the studies show that at all.
Well, that's what is it in health affairs. So, you know, we can debate what study we look at, but certainly that's, you know, let's look at lung cancer. Primary reason for lung cancer, smoking.
No argument.
All right.
And if we could prevent cigarette smoking, we could reduce healthcare spending worldwide.
Man,
so let's do it.
Let me grab one last call and get someone who wants to from Blaine in Minneapolis. Hi, Blaine.
Hi. I would just like to add that I'm a type 1 diabetic. My partner is a transplant recipient because of a congenital defect.
Uh-huh.
And we're in our 30s. You know, we're not talking about people who are retired. We're not talking about, we're 30. And this is hundreds. This is about $500 a month to maintain not our lifestyle, not our enjoyment, but our lives. And this is preventing us from buying a house. It's preventing us from living the lives that we want to. And this is a real problem, and it's not something.
Of course, it's a real problem. And you shouldn't have to compromise your quality of life, your ability to get a house and education and to, you know, have a family the way you want it because of having type 1 diabetes or a congenital defect. But my point is, shouldn't you also be expected to check your blood sugar and go to the doctor and eat a diet that's appropriate to keep you healthy? That's my point. Of course, these things happen to us that aren't our fault, but we have a responsibility to make sure that we also manage our care.
So, Jerry, so let me cue up next Monday, again, when we're going to talk about how much is too much when it comes to cost sharing. Do you have a standard for that? What would you say about that?
Yeah, I don't have a standard for it because I think that cost sharing, it needs to be targeted depending on the condition. You know, I think that a cost sharing, for example, for most hospitalizations doesn't make a lot of sense because the fact is that once you get to that point, providing a financial disincentive to go to the hospital doesn't make sense. But I also think that, you know, we should be providing economic incentives for the kind of health promotion that we're talking about and individual involvement that also incentivizes providers to make sure that patients are managing their conditions. And I don't think that individuals can do this on their own. I don't have an MD, so I don't know necessarily what the best course of action is. But if I am working with my primary care provider who's well-trained, then I can manage my chronic conditions effectively.
Jerry, always a pleasure. Thanks much. Really appreciate your insight. Thank you.
Thank you.
Arkell, good to see you again. Please come back. Great to have you here.
My pleasure.
Our healthcare conversations continue on Monday. And, of course, the vote in the Senate has been put off. So we'll update you on the latest politics around healthcare as well.